Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever and whenever you may be, and welcome to episode 158 of the Fade to Black podcast. I'm Clarice Lockery.
And I'm Hannah Flint.
And, what was the silence? Well, we said last week that Amon is not here.
He's on a special mission. Yeah.
International mission.
International Amon of Mystery.
Yes, which he'll be back next week, and we hope he's having, we know he's having fun because he's sent us pictures of the things that he's doing.
Also, he has posted online to his public account. Has he posted it to public?
Oh, I don't know, because he said last week not to say where he went. So now I'm like,
all right, well,
I don't know the rules. So this week we conquer Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, the 10th film in the franchise, go digging around in Elise Wolvaka's La Chimera, and join Martin Scorsese to explore Made in England, the films of Powell and Pressburger. Plus, in our hot take, we chat about The Hunt for Gollum, the new Lord of the Rings prequel.
My precious.
In the meantime, Hannah, happy birthday week.
Thank you so much. I know.
You went to Thorpe Park.
I did.
But also talk about your feelings of birthday.
Well, I'm always like very reluctant of like taking, you know, when people are like, it's my birth month, it's my birth week. Mm. But you know when you have a birthday where it's like midweek? So you're like, oh, okay, I'll do something with the friends on the weekend. But then luckily my boyfriend and I, we freelance, so we could go to Thorpe Park on Wednesday, which was not only the perfect like weather for it, it was like outside of term time. So there was only like some like sixth formers, I think, and some keen beans and us going to there. So it's pretty quiet. Managed to get on most of the rides, although one of them, annoyingly, we paid for this thing where, you know, like you get like digital photos. Two of the things on the ghost train, it's no Haunted Mansion, I will say.
It's not very good. The Darren Brown one.
Yeah, it's not very good. And there's also we went on The Walking Dead, which was quite good, a roller coaster inside. But it was like, but we couldn't get photos for it, which annoyed. But there are some great photos we got. And also, I realized, like, I don't know, it's been a while since I've been to a theme, but I think the last time I went to a big one might have been with you at D23 and Anaheim. Do you remember a few years? That was our real bonding session, actually.
Intense way to experience a theme park with me.
Yes, it was great. But yeah, so we had fun. That was really fun. And then on the weekend, we had like a nice little, the games on the weekend, played Trivial Pursuits at Drafts, which was cool.
Yes.
Yeah, I had a few people. Clarice was there. Amon came down a bit later we went to Caricio's, which is like a Mexican place in Dalston, like Stoke Newington Road. It was good. Did you have fun?
I had a lot of fun, and I feel like I want to recommend that Mexican place because I had the birria tacos, and they were some of the best Mexican food I've ever had in the UK.
Yeah.
I have to add that at the end.
Yeah. Let's clarify that. In the UK, maybe the worst place, I sometimes feel like the worst Mexican joint in LA is better than the best place here. Do you know what I mean? It's got that sort of like, there's not very many places that does really good.
Yeah. But at this place, they kind of toasted the tortilla in the way that most places in the UK do not get the tortilla right. Mm. So I would definitely recommend. I had nice vibes. I like the music.
Yeah.
And also all your friends are super, super nice.
Aww,
and I like them all very much.
Also, you had the perfect cocktail.
Oh, yeah. Was it
Vampirito? I think it was, because I was having margaritas. Yeah. And I think you had a vampirita. It was like very on theme for you. Yeah.
It didn't taste very, I don't know.
Vampiric?
It didn't taste like the name. Yeah.
Taste blood.
Not that I wanted it to taste of blood, but I thought there would be like a tomato element or something. Yeah. It was good, but it didn't befit the name, I would say.
Do better from Dusk Till Dawn Mexican vampire-themed cocktails. What have you done this week?
That's great. I made some custom ringtones. That's it.
Really?
Because my phone goes off a lot. I guess I get a lot of notifications and I hate the beep, the ding, ding, ding. So I sat and I made custom tones of, because I'm really enjoying at the moment this video compilation of Josh O'Connor doing, all right, the Princess Diana voice.
Oh, really? Josh O'Connor, honestly, he went from like this, like kind of like one level to suddenly challenges, combinations, challenges, La Chimera. And now it's like, duh, everyone's obsession.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I've been on the Josh O'Connor train since. What was
Only
that movie?
You?
Only You. Mm.
And he was I in this one, that, I recommend. He was in this one with, we'll probably get into it later anyway when we talk about La Chimera. But there was one with Shuri. What's her name? Who's Shuri? Who's the actress who plays Shuri?
Oh, Letitia Wright. Oh, Letitia Wright. One that Irish the immigration and he officer plays a, or something.
He plays an Irish guy who does shifts at an immigration halfway house.
Yes.
And they kind of fall in love. And his Irish accent wasn't bad. And I wonder if that's because he's dating Alison Oliver, therefore good practice.
Is that who he's dating?
Yeah, I
From
think so.
From Saltburn?
Yeah, yeah. And Aww. Conversations with... Friends? Is that what it's called? I was about to say conversations with normal people, but that's, I think I've just mashed up
the
book.
Yeah, it's that.
yeah, there we go.
Oh, that's cool. I like her a lot. She's cool. But she's not in any of the films that we're reviewing this week.
Nope.
So let's get into it and start with Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
Are you familiar with the concept of evolution? In their time, humans were capable of many great things.
Noah!
They could fly like eagles fly. They could speak across oceans.
I hate every ape I see, from chimpanzee to chimpanzee. No, you'll never make a monkey out of me. I'm so sorry, Cherie McClure. I butchered your amazing Planet of the Apes song from The Simpsons.
Yeah.
I apologize also to you, Clarice. I apologize
good.
Matt Groening. Everyone involved, you know? But also not too much, because they still... You know, did their poo. So, you know.
Yeah.
They should also be apologizing for a lot of things. But at the moment.
That is true.
I butchered that one. And I will learn
and
it.
And that is a good episode. And also the one where they're like, Dr. Seuss, Dr. Seuss. And they're all. So I should explain. There's a Simpsons episode where Troy McClure is in a Broadway musical adaptation of Planet of the Apes. And they
is
have.
A dog in your flat?
No, I think there's one outside.
Okay, I was going to say, I was like, she's keeping a dog now.
Oh, no, you'd know about it. I don't know where that's coming from. Because usually there's cats, and the dog is probably barking at the cats.
What are you going to do? What are you going to do?
Oh, yeah, so they have multiple songs. So there's that one, and there's also to the tune of Amadeus, and they're going around in a circle going, Dr. Seuss, Dr. Seuss. It's a really good episode. And I don't even like The Simpsons that much, but I really enjoy that one.
I'm going to find it later on and watch it. Okay, but for now, let's crack on with Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Apes, the film is set several generations in the future following Caesar's reign, in which apes are the dominant species living harmoniously, and humans have been reduced to live in the shadows. That's somewhat incorrect. As a new tyrannical ape leader builds his empire, one young ape undertakes a harrowing journey that will cause him to question all that he has known about the past, and to make choices that will define a future for apes and humans alike. Directed by Wes Ball and written by Josh Friedman, it stars Owen Teague, Freya Allen, Kevin Durand, Peter McConn, and William H. Macy. Okay, so it's like the 10th one, I guess. I guess what's been your feeling of the kind of recent run? I actually watched, on my birthday actually, we watched on our birthday film that evening was Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and several episodes of Always Sunny, specifically the Thunder, Thundergun episode. We're trying to get to see Thundergun.
Oh my god, yes. That's really good.
Yeah, but I remember, so Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, but it kind of reminded me, like, watching that one, how much I kind of thought, so a lot of it was quite illogical. Like, I totally get certain things of it, but I was just like, there were certain things that just didn't make any sense to me about, like, I mean, I get it's all about hubris, and then the opening credits of this opening statement is like, ah, humans and their hubris brings them down. So I guess, and then I didn't bother watching Rise of the Planet of the Apes, because who has a time? I guess, did you do that, watch anything in preparation? And I guess, how do you feel like the kind of logic sticks in this one?
So I didn't rewatch them. I'd seen them all. And I don't know, it's kind of a weird franchise because I remember going to see every single one and going, oh, that's a good movie. And then I never think about it again. Like, I remember going to the basement of the Barbican to watch, was it War of the Planet of the Apes? The last one?
Yeah, sorry, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, the first one, then it's Dawn, and then it's War.
And then it's War.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I remember, like, I don't remember anything about the movie. I think they had horses. They were like, oh, the apes have got horses now. Oh, no. And I remember walking out going, yeah, that was pretty good. But I don't know what I thought about it. I have no, and I feel like a lot of people talk about, you know, we had this argument about Avatar not having a cultural footprint, which I disagree. I think it does. Mm. I feel like maybe Planet of the Apes doesn't not have a cultural footprint, but I feel like I never hear about it until a new one comes out. Mm. And then everyone's like, oh yeah, pretty good. And then we just don't talk about it again. So that's my feeling about the, like, I don't know. That's my feeling about Planet of the Apes. And I will say I feel kind of the same about this one, where it's, yeah, it is, I think it's a well-crafted film and it's well-made and there are things that are very impressive about it. But you're right. The story, I think, is a little complex in ways that aren't thematically interesting. I'll say that because, I mean, we're building from this. I think this is because it's such a long-running franchise and we're building from this original very simple idea of what if a guy crash lands on a planet and then, oh no, it was Earth all along, hubris. But now we're having to make 10 films about that one idea. And I think it's been spun out to such an extreme now that I have to say I'm starting to lose grasp of what's going on with this one. I don't know. I guess we don't want to say what it is, but there's sort of a thing that happens halfway through where we're introducing a completely new element to the story that I'd never seen before. I don't think it's in any of the previous movies. Specifically to do with what humanity's been up to. That I was like, I have so many more questions now that this movie doesn't answer. And I think they're trying to make you wait for a sequel. And I understand that. But I would like some explanation now. Because that's going to take several years.
Yeah.
And I walked out being like, what?
It just made me walk out and think, Fundamentally, if you think about, I understand that the humans have been decimated, right, forever. Mm-hmm. But if you think, right, it starts, it's San Francisco, right? And if I get this right, just, maybe I've got this wrong, but like, not, the virus that's released is not the same thing that makes them smart, is it?
I think it is. They were trying to find a cure for dementia, right?
Alzheimer's, right? But then, okay, so, but I, for some reason, maybe, so it's the same thing that they, that made them smart, so it spread around. So we're saying that, like, apes in other zoos around America also got smart. Because my thing is this, it's like, the apes are quite smart, but they're not smart, like, crazy smart. They're, like, not, like, human intellect level or smart. They're like, they're doing okay, but there's a very small number of them. And the idea of even the War of the Planet was like, America's massive. America's massive. And there's all these things that have just been left. Weapons, blah, blah, blah. All this stuff that you don't really need to turn on. So this is, I mean, look, I think I have to like take that out of the take that out of my like frame of mind, because it just gets, if I get too stickler on the fact that this doesn't quite make sense if this is how you're going to do it, because realistically, and what I guess the problem with this, it's trying to be quite realistic. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So I guess why they put in something in this and their opening, and I appreciate it, put like an opening kind of like, kind of said this, give context, like what is it, I guess the crawl or whatever, it's not a crawl, but you know what I mean, but it's like the prologue or something. So it's like, yes, and now the humans are regressing, so they can't speak anymore and they're losing their smarts, but some of them aren't. And I guess that's the weird thing about this, it's kind of trying to do a lot of things. And I wonder also, again, when I was watching Another Planet of the Apes, I was like, oh, like Cobra and Caesar is kind of like Professor X and Magneto, you know? It's like the one who was raised, who was traumatized, raised by, like, raised in a world where he was violent, he was imprisoned in his cage. Magneto, it's like it was a Holocaust survivor, blah, blah. Whereas, like, Caesar was raised by lovely, you know, humans. He had pretty much privilege. He is Professor X, who, like, Professor X, rich guy, he was a massive mansion. You know what I mean? So it's like, okay. And then this one, now I'm watching this one, I'm like, okay, this feels a bit derivative now. Like, what I'm seeing is that they're just basic, kind of copying and pasting a few bits and bobs from other kind of sci-fi franchises in order to pad it out. Even when I was watching this, it reminded me of, what's it called, that one that that was recently on, is it Monsters? Something called Monsters with, what's his face? He was the Maze Runner.
The Dylan O'Brien
Dylan
one.
Dylan O'Brien one. Yes. For some reason, this reminded me of this. That reminded me of this as well. I guess because of the journey, it's kind of like a road trip journey. I guess then for you, I suppose, did you, I guess the kind of like plot elements of it, you know, it's, we've got now, we've got apes versus clans, it's really got that, I mean, God, like, you love Romans, you love classics, I mean, for many people, this is their Roman Empire, and now it's doubly their Roman Empire, but I guess, like, how did you think that kind of, I guess what they were picking and choosing, incorporating into the sort of lore, and how they brought the other dynamics as the plot kind of went on, and the kind of breadth. I guess it's kind of, I quite like the pacing of it and the stuff that we discover. I like the introduction of like Nova, who is the human girl. You know, I think that was quite well done. But how do you think it kind of all kind of patchworked together? Did you feel like it was like a cozy watch?
It is derivative, I would say, in the sense, well, it's very familiar, because what I did like about it is that, you know, we don't so often see now, because of, you know, comic book movies, other priorities, movies that feel like, yeah, narrative wise or spectacle wise they're trying to draw from like the really old like Hollywood classical epics. And I feel like this was kind of trying to be traditional in that way, because it was very like, it was very spectacle focused. Like, they have a scene where they come to the bad ape camp, and it's like there's this big gate and there's horses and the like, and then the Proximus, the Kevin Durant character, who's like the big bad ape, comes and he does this speech of like, ah, what a wonderful day.
Oh, which is like, I'm sorry, Mad Max Fury, it's a wonderful day. That's what I mean. Yeah. I was like, what are we watching?
Yeah. So I think it's kind of, I would say, yeah, Fury Road is kind of another one where it's sort of nice, because it has slightly different beats and slightly different priorities to a lot of the, you know, and not just comic books, but like Top Gun, Mission Impossible, the sort of big Hollywood movies we're seeing at the moment. So I like that it's very like, they go on the journey, there's a big scene with the fire, and then there's a big scene in rapids, and then they climb a mountain. And it's like, yes, I've seen 30 million movies where they do that, but it's, I think the way that it's executed, it's like, it's, I think it's well done. There's like a good pacing to it, as you said. I think the VFX work is really good. Yeah. Insanely,
like kind of wild when you thought Dawn of the Planet of the Apes was like, that was great. And then you're watching this and it was like, oh, this is how they should picture. This is the photorealistic stuff that really works.
To the point that I like was not interested in the human.
Yes.
I didn't think that character was very interesting, because I guess when she first appears, she doesn't have any, she's meant to be not have any speech, but she also like just doesn't have any emotions. She's just sort of fierce. And I didn't feel like I learned anything about that character or understood the reasons for her motivations.
I do think that was part of the sort of, like, there's a really good bit where it's, I thought it really grapples with, like, you know, who has what, you know, it was ours first, you know, things like that. And you're like, oh yeah, it's like, who can you trust? Because actually, no matter what, it's all about power. It's all about control. Mm. And actually what you realize is that, again, what I think is quite interesting about Planet of the Apes is that we are descended from apes. There is a sense of, like, who is in charge? Who's the leader? You know, there's this kind of sense of, like, you know, I love how it's like clans turned into a kingdom, you know, and you can't have a kingdom without a king, you know, things like that, which I thought was, like, really interesting. And I didn't mind as much, but I do think the girl is quite I don't think I've seen the actress in anything before. I don't know.
What's She's from The Witcher. I say I liked her a lot more in The Witcher. I think this performance, I don't know. I think maybe you needed a really charismatic actor to pull that off, because I just feel enough coming from her.
She was very much like all business. Like, I'm here to do a job.
Yes.
And that's what it was. It's actually kind of very much like, again, like the sort of Sarah Connor sort of thing. And I don't mind it necessarily in the stoicism of it, because I actually quite like the other characters. But again, when it's the only female character who has got a significant role. I wish there was a bit more humor. I mean, I love the Raka character, who's the orangutan. I mean, I thought that was quite funny. I thought those, again, the eight performances were so well done. I did feel that. I was like, just stick on the apes. They're really interesting. I like the Proximus, who's like King Louis, kind of like crazy badass. And I thought, again, some of the the stakes of it. Of the climbing, the kind of, that was just quite really beautifully shot. I think it was just a very safe film. Do you know what I mean? It was just like, I'm not gonna like push the goalposts. I'm here to do a job. I'm gonna get good performance out of these good mocap performances. I guess it's mocap, right? Performances on the actors. We've got a kind of interesting stuff with a kind of really, really, some of the fight sequences between the apes are really quite scary. And I always find that, like, you really have that strong mind of just, like, how strong apes are compared to humans. Like, you really get that sense. But I think there's a nice balance of humor. Yeah, it's a really kind of classic storytelling. You're right on that one.
Yeah, I will say, I do feel bad. Apes are not my favorite creature. I do find them quite scary. I think because they are so close to us in intelligence, but we can't really read them because they are a different species. I'm always like, ugh, what do you know about me? I don't know. So maybe that's impacting my take. I will say one thing about the ape design, and I know this is a thing that's happened in all the Planet of the Apes movies, but I would feel like at this point, why do the girl chimps have like little like Bob situation?
Like, and barely have any titties.
Obviously, like, when it was, you know, the 60s and the Tim Burton one, it was more exaggerated costuming. So but they're meant to be photorealistic animals now. Yeah. And from my understanding, female chimps in the wild don't have little blunt cut bobs.
No, they don't.
So why is that? And I feel like it's very, you know, boobies. It's like when
they do have boobies.
Yeah, they always have to like mark out that it's a girl animal. It's like when in How to Train Your Dragon and they made girl toothless, she was like pink with a little bow. I just hate it.
Because people get confused and they need gendered.
Yeah.
Also, I will say this. There's one point where the orangutan goes, oh, he's like, he's lost his friend. And he's like, he was my village. I was like, is this orangutan gay? Is this a gay ape? I'm like, I don't mind it. I don't mind it, but I'm a bit like, what?
It's one of those things where it's like, oh, but this is what always happens with Hollywood movies, right? They have one line from the one character who then doesn't talk about it ever again.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, so now that, you know, everyone who made this movie can go, we're allies.
Yeah.
Because they put one reference in. So maybe that one orangutan is gay.
Yeah. I guess also there was, I do think I quite like the, this idea about who writes history. And like, it was really, I quite like the idea that even just, I don't know how many years it's out from Caesar, but I guess like, I want to say maybe like 100, 50 to 100.
Yeah, they said many generations.
Yeah, so that's, but then a generation is
200.
Yeah. What, you think 200 years?
I think it could be.
Do you think so? Wow. No, but it can't be because he's the last generation who knew Caesar, right? No? The orangutan? I want to say 100.
Did he say that he knew him? I don't know. It's very confusing.
Well, there we go. Well, let's wrap it up then. So this is out on in cinemas now. Are you going to say screen, a stream, or skip?
This is tricky. I would maybe say screen to appreciate the VFX work, because I think that would really benefit from a big screen.
I'm going to say stream because I feel like this is the 10th one and I'm not really interested in, like, I don't feel like, not to be a dick, but like, I don't think we need to encourage them to make these movies. So I'm like, watch it at home. I don't think you're going to, anything you see on the screen, I don't think you need to see it on the big screen to really enjoy it, but I think you enjoy it just as much.
I'm also trying to take into account my dislike of primates.
Yeah.
I'm trying to be as unbiased as I can be by giving them. But they do have eagles in this, and I love eagles.
Yes,
so
yes, they do.
That bumped it up a bit.
Well, from one movie touching on ancient history to another, here's the trailer for La Chimera.
Signore, sta sognando?
Era un mezzo mago. Così ce lo siamo portato con noi. Tutta quella bellezza, i vasi, l'oro. Tutto lasciato lì per un mondo che non si sapeva neanche se c'era. Il mondo delle anime.
Cerco la signora Flora.
Te l'avevo detto che sarebbe tornata.
E guarda chi c'è.
L'altro mio unico amico.
Ancient dreams in a modern land. I'm trying to get back as fast I can. Back to a time before I had form. Back to a time before I was born. So that is by Marina, formerly Marina and the Diamonds. Ancient Dreams in a Modern Land. It's a very good song, and I couldn't think of anything else, so I picked that one. This is La Chimera. Just out of jail and still searching for his late beloved Beniamina, crumpled English archaeologist Arthur reconnects with his wayward crew of Tombaroli accomplices, a happy-go-lucky collective of itinerant grave robbers who survive by looting Etruscan tombs and fencing the ancient treasures they dig up. Arthur isn't interested in the artifacts, though. He's seeking a legendary door to the underworld. Enter Beniamina. I feel like the end of that synopsis is up for interpretation.
I did not get that at all from the film.
The synopsis is telling us stuff that the
film
that is
did
the
not.
Person who wrote this synopsis has an opinion on the movie.
Yeah. There you go.
Written and directed by Elisa Warvaca, it stars Josh O'Connor, Carol Duarte, Vincenzo Nemolato, Alba Warvaca, who is Alicia's sister, and Isabella Rossellini, who we all know and love. So I loved this movie so much.
Yeah.
For kind of obvious and unobvious reasons. But I think maybe let's start with Josh O'Connor, because this movie suddenly got a boost of publicity after Challengers, which I found really interesting and quite smart. And I think a lot of it is obviously because of the performance that Josh O'Connor gives in this. And we've been kind of talking about the fact that we're seeing a bit of a new side to him. Because I would say this is another kind of untypical Josh O'Connor role. I don't know. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, he seems to be, I think when you play Prince Charles and do a really posh boy kind of performance, and also maybe, I don't know. Yeah, I think when you get like the Crown or do one of those roles, I think you really want to shake off and shed the skin of any preconceived notions of what that person is. I think about like how I remember once interviewing James Norton, and I guess he's done a few things where he's played like posh, I mean, posh boy. So when he got like the what's it, Happy Valley, it was like, I really just didn't want to get period dramas, you know, I didn't want to be known for that sort of thing. And I guess for this one, he's like, I don't want to be typecast as like Eton boy. And so for this, God, I forget the name of it. I think that's the film Aisha. And challenges, and obviously this one, it's like, hey, look, I'm a bit of rough. But even with this one, I find interesting about it is that he is, in a way, sort of playing a kind of like a rogue, like a kind of, he is a bit of, I mean, he's a British archaeologist, you know, he wears this very, very lovely linen suit for pretty much most of the time. He does look a kind of a rakish kind of sort of figure who's like, I don't know, he's given a bit of like Withnail somewhat, you know what I mean? There's a bit of loviness around him. You know, someone who could obviously went to university, obviously is a very intelligent, smart person, speaks several languages, knows his stuff about archaeology, but something's happened in his life. He's, you know, his love has gone missing, and he's just basically kind of like, in a way, kind of coasting along and trying to like, I guess try and, I feel like there's something about the character where he is stuck in this purgatory, really, and he's stuck in the past, both in the sense of what he does for a living and what he does as a kind of helping these kind of mad bunch of like, I guess, like bandits, like messy bandits, tomb raiders, into helping them get these artifacts, but also stuck in the past of like this relationship, this love. And I think it's a real, and also he's got this kind of magical realist gift. You know, he's kind of divining, what they call it at one point.
Divining rods.
Yeah, but there's something else they called it. Yeah, I know the water diviner.
Oh, and then he has the visions, which I think they called La Chimera in there. They referred to it as La Chimera in there.
Yeah. So I think I really quite enjoy him in this. I think he's really good at doing the very like standoffish, aloof, temperamental sort of person, but also knows how to switch on the charm. And it can be quite disarming. I mean, he's got a very, very gorgeous smile where it's like, melts your heart. So I think there's something really, something really sensuous about his performance, I think.
Yeah, because he doesn't, for being the main character and the protagonist, he doesn't have that much dialogue because, you know, he's speaking Italian and everyone makes fun of his Italian. So I think he just sort of shuts up at one point. So there's a lot of him. Yeah. Just a lot of him kind of looking and observing and feeling quite centered with the artifacts and like having some really, really profound, deep, tactile connection with them. And as you said, yeah, it's very much a movie about our connection with the past, and then that's through history. I don't know, did you see, I hadn't seen it, and I only watched it for the first time this week, the last one that she did, Happy as Lazaro,
no, I haven't seen that one, and I keep on meaning to see it.
It's really good. Yeah, so I'd missed it when it came out, and I was like, this is the week I'm going to watch it. And I would say it's kind of really quite similar to this in terms of it's very kind of dreamy, mythological, really rooted in like Italian ancient history, the past. Very ambivalent in the way that I think you can put so much of your own take on it, which we were talking about the synopsis here. So I want to talk about this relationship, how the past and how she's filming this. The synopsis saying that he's seeking a legendary door to the underworld, which is interesting because the movie never says that at any point. But I think a lot of people, and I picked up on this, think there's sort of like an Orpheus and Eurydice situation going on with Arthur and Beniamina. But I also thought, because there's this really beautiful scene where he's remembering her, and it's her pulling at a thread that's come undone from her dress. So the thread's like stuck in the ground. And that scene comes back around in a way near the end of the movie that I thought was so moving and like really made me cry. But that made me think of the Ariadne and Theseus, which is the woman who gives Theseus this ball of yarn when he goes into the maze to fight the Minotaur. And that's the way he's able to find his way back out. So it's interesting. I think there's an interesting question in this movie of,
does he die or does he live?
Exactly. Who's dead? Who's alive? Who is lost? Who is leading? And you could say either way, because Beniamina technically is the one who's gone. She's probably dead, but the movie never says for sure. And he's still really trying to find her. And Isabella Rossellini plays her mother, who is convinced that she's not dead. So, I've rambled, but please add your thoughts.
Love that idea. And now that you kind of add that sort of, I guess, there is something of, like, there's something theatrical, like, very kind of, when you think about, like, there's the chorus, like, you have the kind of sisters who are all kind of trying to henpeck at the mother, trying to get to move out. And then you have the bandits, and then you have the kind of, like, each of the characters, it kind of, in a way, is a little bit like, what do we watch? Like, Bo is Afraid, but obviously not that intense, but that kind of, going back to the kind of classic plays and like that sort of theatre and the way that we show it, and you've got the hero's journey and then you have these little people he's kind of like collected on the way and they're going through stuff, and exactly what you said about like his, like whether it's, you know, Orpheus going fine trying to find thingy, you know, I love the idea, oh, God, I love that one, it's like he can't look back or if she looks back because he goes into like the Hades hell to try and find her and all that, and obviously La Chimera is a kind of an ancient it's interesting because in my head I thought La Chimera was like a beast, and I suppose there's a kind of nod to it as like a woman who is like something that's like a one of those kind of like a dog, and then it's only got two heads or something in classic tradition of like a mythic beast.
I don't know Italian, but I think, I don't know if it's meant to be that. I don't know. You are right. It is the creature, but I don't know.
I guess it's, I think there's this really traditional feel to the way that the kind of like the acts of it, the way it's set up, but there's also kind of whimsy to it. And a kind of sense of humor that not irreverent, but I guess like a bit like kooky about it. I found it quite funny, especially the character of Italia, who is a really interesting person who's quite forthright and kind of a bit of a weirdo as well. I love the way that she also forces, I guess, she holds a mirror up to Josh O'Connor's Artur, which I really like that sort of dynamic. And you've got this kind of, I guess, this, I like the kind of characters of like, everything that she, even though she's been through this thing, she's kind of still kind of has this belief in the kind of what's right and what's wrong, like I guess morality and the sense of believing in spirits and the kind of like that element. And then you've got someone who spends so much time in the past but has no qualms about digging up graves. Like I really love this idea, the kind of repetitive like motive of like, you know, this is not for human eyes. Then there's this amazing kind of like, I guess I really like the, you know, there's a sort of like synchronicity of bringing in characters from the beginning and they come back at the end. And I love the way it kind of plays with your ideas, like what's real, what isn't. And I think that's what's quite remarkable about the film, especially by doing it in a period setting, because it's like the 80s. So you've got that sort of period setting with the metatext, and then you've got that sort of meta narrative of like looking historically into the past and then different past. So there's a lot of layers to this one, which I thought was just really beautifully like paired out visually, like stunning. And Helene Louvart, who's the cinematographer, who's got two movies out actually. She had a movie out last week, which is called Nezua, which is a Syrian film, and by Sudad Kaden. Just like a real treat, a real like really like sublime treat of a film, I think.
I want to add one more thing about the Italian character. Because Happy as Lazara has kind of a similar idea of having someone who is almost representative of, I guess, like the spirit of Italy. Like this, I don't know, there's something a little bit supernatural about her for me. And this idea of her coming, yeah, in situation and saying, these things are not for you to own. And I think the movie also asks a lot of questions about, you know, not just specifically, you know, artifacts, Etruscan artifacts, but she leads him to this abandoned train station. And there's this question of who owns this building? Is it someone's or is it no one's? And I really love that, the way that it handles that, this idea of who owns the past, but in a really, really broad sense. Yeah. And it's sort of quite, yeah, and it's very, like, I feel like her movies are very kind of very anti-capitalist. I don't want to put too firm by saying communist, but like communal, the idea of sharing things and sharing the past and relinquishing the idea that you should be owning things that are beautiful, things that are art, things that are history. I love, because it's sort of quite a political movie in a way, but in a very kind of subtle, dreamy way, I would say.
I think you're right.
So let's go to our screen, stream, or skip on La Chimera. Hannah.
Screen.
Me. Screen. and also I would say I love that it's the Etruscans, because they don't. Although Isabella Rossellini, the last movie I saw her in, Cat Person, also about the Etruscans. So I would love for someone to ask her if she's got some sort of special interest in them.
Who is she? Is she like the
She was the professor. Do you remember she ass? Was... Yes. Wasn't she not the lady? Was she not an anthropology student studying the Etruscans in Cat Person?
Yeah, maybe. I've kind of blocked them.
Because I remember thinking the Etruscans were a really weird choice. Sorry, this is a sideline. Because someone in La Chimera talks about how the Etruscans had much better gender equality than the Romans. Mm. So I was thinking it's a weird choice for a movie like Cat Person, because they were trying to use the Etruscans as like a misogyny thing, but don't pick them.
Someone did not do their research.
Someone didn't do their research, but Alice Vol... Sorry, I fucked her name up. Alice. But... Alicia Vorwacker did, so props to her. I mean, she is Italian, so she probably just knows it.
Yeah. Also, I like that this is like two for two, Josh O'Connor released films with Italian directors. Italiano.
Yeah.
So now, honorary Italian.
Yeah, get your passport, Josh. Let's go. But we are moving away from Italy for the next movie, and we're headed to England.
Some of the very first moving images that I can remember seeing are from Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger.
I have never met a person who not only understood what I was driving at, but guessed already half of it before I said it.
They were like experimental filmmakers working within the system.
Do we have a go at each other?
Not really. In a few hours' time, he sees that I was right.
London calling to the faraway towns. Now war is declared and battle comes down. London calling to the underworld. Come out of your cupboards, you boys and girls. Martin Scorsese reflects on the influence of filmmakers Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, whose decades-long collaboration led to a series of classics that made the duo a crucial part of British cinema. Narrated and presented by Martin Scorsese and directed by David Hinton. It's interesting that it's come out because they've just done the Powell and Pressburger season at BFI. I saw The Red Shoes on the big screen for the first time. It's really interesting, and they had a nice little exhibition. But I have to admit, I recently watched also the Bluebeard's Castle recently on BFI Player. But I have to admit, it's actually a bit of a gap in my knowledge, Powell and Pressburger. What was your kind of understanding of the duo prior to the Rutchiness?
So I have seen like The Big Dogs. So I've Red Shoes is one of my favorite movies. I just think it's so beautiful. And I think very influential then on a lot of filmmakers that I really adore. They always quote the Red Shoes. I don't know. I love Black Narcissus. The one I watched with the season coming up was they had they did a re-release of I Know Where I'm Going, the one where she goes to Scotland, which is in black and white. Because I think my thing with Powell and Pressburg is I'm always just stunned at their use of color. And Scorsese talks about it in this movie. I just think they, in terms of filmmakers, there's something so magical about it that no one in that early period of Technicolor, I think, quite matched. But even though it's in black and white, I thought I Know Where I'm Going was very good. And he talks as well about sincerity in this. And I think there is something incredibly empathetic about their movies and like very humane. And that's always stood out to me. The one I hadn't seen and I want to see now is The Tales of Hoffman, because he kind of said it wasn't very good in the documentary, but I want to see it.
I think I want to see really the fun. Colonel Blimp one, Life and Death of Colonel Blimp.
That is great. Yeah. That and the duel scene that he's talking about is insane.
Yeah. I guess how much do you think that, I guess, as much as it's about Powell and Pressburger, actually, by having Martin Scorsese very much, not insert himself, but really kind of, is really kind of the linchpin in that we kind of, he's the one taking us through. We learn a lot about Martin Scorsese and a lot about his films through Powell and Pressburger. How much do you think that actually it makes it far more, adds or takes away from the documentary that, because he's such a present part of it, he narrates it, he talks about his first time he saw stuff when he was watching, on TV, British cinema, which I thought was really interesting. I really enjoyed it, actually. I think I would enjoy this documentary far more because I'm so much more aware of Martin Scorsese's work. Therefore, I quite like it when I see, I remember like finally going to see Battleship Potemkin after watching a documentary and I was like, oh, The Untouchables. But you know what I mean? It's like, you know what I mean? It's like, I kind of like that. And then I understand that Martin Scorsese is far closer to me than before that. What did you think about that sort of, I guess, the perspective and positioning and the framing device?
Yeah, so I had read a lot already about Martin Scorsese's feelings about Powell and Pressburger. So the stuff about him growing up, but I just love hearing him talk. I think I could watch every documentary narrated and presented by Martin Scorsese because there's something about the balance that he strikes in this documentary where you have the sense of context of what else was going on in the film industry at this point. I really liked how he talked about how Powell and Pressburger's movies kind of post-war were really diverted from the trend of film noir and how that was, so cynical and such a sense of darkness that the endings necessarily were quite punishing towards the protagonist. While Powell and Pressburger movies had happy endings and were about kind of dreams and beauty and love. And the whole thing with A Matter of Life and Death of her going up the staircase is just stunning. I really like they had the context. Then he had also how the movies influenced his work. But also I like that he just would pick out scenes that he really liked, that sometimes I think that is missing from more conventional documentaries, that they're so focused on, we have to tell the story of the person's career. Let's do this. We got to get all the, the essential information in here. I like that because it's Scorsese, he went, actually, no, I'm just going to talk about this little thing that I really like. I think, for example, The Tales of Hoffman in a traditional documentary about Powell and Pressburger would be a side note. They'd go over it very quickly. But because Scorsese watched it so much as a kid, he like really stops and he shows us that scene on the boat and the duel in that. Was it a duel? The fight in that movie, I think because I am fairly familiar with the most famous movies that they've made, I liked him spending so much time on stuff I hadn't seen and I didn't know very much about.
It was interesting to me that, and forgive me if I missed this bit, there was about 10 minutes when I was watching it that I did sleep and I woke myself up back up again. But because it's like 2 hours, 12 minutes, right? So it's not too long, but I'm very tired this week. but Michael Powell was married to Thelma Shoemaker.
Yes.
And I forgive me if I'm wrong, but she's literally like, is there any acknowledgement of that?
Yes.
Yeah, did I miss that? Is that one little end? Right. Okay. That might have been like the little bit. Yeah. Because I was like, oh.
Yeah, he does mention at the end, he talks about his personal relationship with Michael Powell, and he says it's through Thelma Shoemaker because they got married and then he would spend loads of time with him.
Yeah, I guess, but there was earlier on, he said from the early bit, it was he came to London because he'd just done Mean Streets, and then he got a meeting with him at a pub, and he said, oh, I thought he seemed really bored, but then Michael Powell wrote about in his biography saying, oh, finally, I have blood rushing through my veins again. It felt like finally I've been reinvigorated. And I love the idea that he got that kickstart, but I guess for you then, how do you think it balanced, like, it's Powell and Pressburger. Does tip a little bit, have tipped more towards the Michael Powell side of things. But I guess it's made in England and he is the Brit.
Yeah, I think that you could criticize it for that because obviously Martin Scorsese knew Michael Powell very well, so he has a lot to say about him. I don't think it's short on detail about Pressburger. I mean, you know, there's a section on his background on how I really liked when they're talking about the spy in black, saying because he was a Jewish man who lived in Berlin and had a really, you know, special experience there, obviously pre-Nazism, it was really important for him in this spy in black movie that they were making, that's a propaganda film, anti-Nazi propaganda film, to differentiate the idea of, you know, having German characters who are not Nazis in that movie. Yeah. And to present Nazism as an ideology. I thought that, like, that's a really interesting biographical kind of tidbit that I thought was great they included. So, yeah, I don't know. I think they had a good balance.
That was in the 49th parallel as well. That one where he's talking about the scene where then the Nazis have escaped to Canada and they come across a German community and it was like...
The Spy in Black. I'm talking about the wrong movie.
Oh, okay, But I mean, this is the thing. There's so many to get from. I definitely feels like one of those... I love it when you watch a documentary and it really makes you want to see the films that are on display. And even if you might have certain things they give away, it's not really giving it away. I guess for you then, like, do you think this is also a good documentary for people who might not have the most, like, I guess, in not inside baseball knowledge, but like coming from a more of like a film fan, more of a sit down a cinephile angle?
I would say it serves both quite well, because he does spend a lot of time on the Red Shoes, on Black Narcissus, on A Matter of Life and Death, like the really, really big movies. He's not really breaking down a lot of the film terms that he's using. So maybe that might be a little bit alienating. Mm-hmm. I would say, like a casual film fan, I would say this is perfect for. Maybe someone who has absolutely no interest in film, realistically, would not get much out of this. And then I would say someone who is familiar with Powell and Pressburger, I would still say they can get something out of it because there are these like very kind of little interesting tidbits here and there that I had never heard before, and him talking about his friendship. Great photos as well, and like behind the scenes stuff. Mm-hmm. I always like seeing that footage. So I think most people can get something out of this.
Yeah, and also Martin Scorsese fans, I think they'll enjoy it.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's do. Is it in cinemas?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. So, what's your screen, stream, or skip verdict, Clarice?
I would say screen. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna say screen because I think then you'll get to enjoy some of the kind of colors and stuff on the big screen, and you'll be like, oh, I want to see the all, and then you get yourself down to one of those special screens.
Yeah.
If you can.
And also, they shoot Martin Scorsese in a cinema, and it's like he's talking to you. So if you're in a cinema too, you can pretend Martin Scorsese's in the room with you.
I did see, of course he's reading from a script, but I did see his eyes moving. And I was like, You're not nailing that auto cue, Marty. But can't win them all. Can't win them all.
You can't do everything.
You can't be one of the most visionary directors in the world and also read auto cue without...
He didn't have time to learn the script. He's busy making TikToks, so... having to stop his dog from biting Paul Schrader's finger off. So he's got a lot going on. We've got one thing before we head off, and that is our
hot
tip. Oh my God. I'm not plugged in today. But you know, we do it every week, so you know how
you know what it is. What we need to do is just do... We should actually just record a really nice hot take jingle and just throw it in there, then it's done. Hot da 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 tick 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 hot da 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 tick 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 tick.
I don't know, I like that it's a bit different each week. It just wasn't good this week, and that's my fault. So I apologize.
We're missing Amon's baritone. The harmonizing was just not quite there. We're throwing ourselves off.
Yeah. So the news has come in that Warner Brothers will be dipping their toes back into Middle Earth. Again, I mean, there's a War of the Rohirrim anime coming on Netflix this year already. So they're re-dipping the dipping that has already dipped into Middle Earth with a new, I want to say prequel, but I'm not entirely sure, called The Hunt for Gollum, which will be produced by Peter Jackson, Fran Walsh, and Philippa Boyens of Lord of the Rings fame, and will star Andy Serkis and also be directed by Andy Serkis, who, of course, did Venom, Let There Be Carnage, a fantastic movie. I don't know about this.
No. I'm done. I feel like it's like at this point, this is real just like IP flog.
Yes, because we had Lord of the Rings, fantastic movies. Yeah. Then we had The Hobbit, which I watched the first one and I just stopped there because, you know, I was good. I didn't want to go back. I didn't want to go there. But I've heard they're not very good. And now we're not even doing the Silmarillion, which if you were going to do something, maybe at least go there. They haven't actually said what the plot is, but I'm assuming...
Wasn't that supposed to be Ring of Power, Rings of Power, though, Silmarillion?
Sort of, I guess. But then that's a different universe. That's, like, not the Peter Jackson Middle Earth, even though it looks exactly like it. This is what's so confusing about it, is that you're so right. This idea of just like wanting to crank things out of the IP because they know that Lord of the Rings is popular, and also Harry Potter is done, so they don't have that. They have to go back to Lord of the Rings. I just feel like I'm scared we are going to reach a like oversaturation point with Lord of the Rings things, because there's going to be season two of The Rings of Power. They have the anime, The War of the Rohirrim, and now they're doing this thing, which I am presuming the plot will be when that bit in The Fellowship of the Ring where the Sauron finds Gollum and tortures him and gets the information Baggins Shire out of him, right?
No, I think it's going to be...
What is it going to be then?
I think it's probably going to be during the period where Gollum turns into Gollum, as we know it, from the Hobbit to Gollum.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, they were trying to find him for a while. I think it's not going to have any of them. I think it's going to be like, I don't know. Like Prey. I don't know. Do you know what I mean? It's just like God. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think the only way I would say is that period where he had it. Because he had the ring for a real good long time. So I think they're not going to do it where like Frodo and stuff. So I don't think it's going to be that.
No.
I actually think it's going to be like a prequel, pre Lord of the Rings. And you know, we get a glimpse of that little like, I think it's the beginning of Return of the King where we learn about how Gollum gets the ring, right? Where he's like, we're like, oh, look at that. It's Andy Serkis. That's what Gollum really looked like, Andy Serkis.
And he kills his friend to get the ring.
Yeah, kills his friend to get the ring. And I think what we might see is like some point in that period. Because right, they'll be hunting for it. Because they'll be using it. Because they'll be using it. Yeah.
Yes.
So they're like, oh, where the fuck are you, Gollum? Ringwraiths are going to be like, get that fucking...
So that's pre-Hobbit, because he finds the ring and then he goes to...
Yeah, so I think it's pre-Hobbit. I think it's pre-Hobbit, pre-Lord of the Rings. I think it's literally that period where what thingy gets... Because it's in the... Falls into it thing, because who gets killed? Is it... Isildur. I'm actually not going to be mad if we get to have it back and just hear him say, Galadriel, Isildur. And then I think it's going to be elves trying to look for this ring. And then I think it's going to be some orcs trying to look for this ring. And I think it's going to be some men trying to look for this ring. So it could be, it's a mad hunt for Gollum. What if it's a comedy? Okay.
Yeah.
So that's how I think, that's the only way that I can imagine them doing it that would actually give them the freedom to do something original that doesn't affect the timeline.
Yes.
So doesn't affect the rest of it.
Right. And I guess it would end with, so maybe the returning character would be Smaug, which was Benedict Cumberbatch, right?
Yeah. Are there going to be returning characters? Is that what he said? Some of them are going to be there.
Well, I would assume they would not be doing it without that.
Well, we could also get Morfydd Clark or Cate Blanchett. I think we're going to, you know.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing about these elves. What if Orlando Bloom comes back?
Could do. Or you could have, like, young Denethor. Because I guess then you could have, like, someone from Rohan.
It annoys me because it's definitely not anything that I want.
No.
But the only way I'd be interested in it, if it was that specific time frame where it feels like you're not you know what I mean? You're not like crossing over. I don't know. I feel like that can be a contained story if you just do it like that. Oh, there was one hunt, but he actually gets away with it because it's Gollum.
Yeah.
But you're like, shit, is he going to lose it?
Yeah. I think the thing with all of these things that get announced. And this is how I feel about the Fantastic Four movie as well, is that objectively there's elements I like there. I think, like, I really enjoyed Venom, Let There Be Carnage. I think Andy Serkis is clearly a good director and has lots of ideas. But it's that, I think it's what you're talking about, it's that feeling of, like, exhaustion, because there's something almost inevitable about this. And we know that they didn't, whatever Andy Serkis is going to bring to it, and he might make a fantastic movie, I'm very open to that. But I think it's the idea that this doesn't exist because Andy Serkis has, like, the burning fire within himself to tell Gollum's story. It's because Warner Brothers, specifically David Zaslav, what IP can we crank money out of? Harry Potter's gone down the shit. DC is doing whatever it's doing, hopefully on the up. What else can we crank money out of? And Lord of the Rings was just next on the board, and now this is what we have to do now, is that we have to have all these Lord of the Rings movies.
It's just wild to me, because it's the fact that the Fall Guy hasn't made as much money as it should have done. That's like, go to cinemas to see that. There's actually, you know what, talking about, you were talking about It's Always Sunny at the start, and then there's the Thunder Gun episode. Sorry for people who aren't into Always Sunny, but I've been converted, and now we are converting the masses. And by the masses, we mean our very niche audience of Fade to Black, which we love every single one of you.
Already will be.
You probably could teach me about Always Sunny.
Yeah.
But basically, like, there's also, in season 14, there's the Thunder Gun 4, and they do, like, a kind of, like, test thing, market research thing, where they watch it, and there's a bit where they're being really just stupid, outlandish, like, moaning about PC and liberal, blah, blah, all sort of this, and the woman's like, actually, the reason why they're doing this is moving on because we have to lower the age rate because all of you fans are not watching it in cinemas. You're just pirating it. And then you say you want new stuff, or you say you want this thing, but you don't. You don't want to pay for it. And it kind of comes into that thing. It's like people moan about not having new stuff and reboots and stuff like that. But like, whatever. And I know this technically, the Fall Guy is loosely based on something existing IP, but it's so far and far removed from the Fall Guy TV show. You know, it's only certain elements. And it's like, you could go see that. And then maybe they'll be like, oh, let's actually invest more in these, like, things, in these kind of a more, like, you know, original, you know, first time movie on big screen projects, you know? Or, like, you know, I kind of feel like there's so many books out there. There are so many books out there, so many fantasy series. Like, where's Sarah? Yeah. Oh, God, like, I'd love to see, like, oh, God, you know what I'd love? I'd love Saga. Where's that? Where's Saga?
Oh, my God, I love the, yes. Yeah. Well, but maybe no, because I feel like they might not do a good job of it.
No, no. Also, I was thinking, like, everyone, like, God, there's so much stuff, like, even, like, the like so much fairy stuff, like, fae stuff. I don't understand why it hasn't been a lot of, like, fae adaptations in the big screen yet. And I think it may be because the target audience is women.
Yeah.
When I think about the Sarah Maas stuff and the court, which I read years ago, and all these people just thought I was like, I read this 10 years ago, I think. I think it was came out quite a while ago, some of the stuff.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
Maybe not 10 years ago, but I'm pretty sure, because I used to read so much. Like, it came out at a time at, like, where it's Cassandra Clare, you know, that sort of thing.
Yes.
I would actually love them to do the prequel version of Mortal Instruments. Is that what it is? Not Mortal Instruments.
Mortal Engines.
No, not Mortal Engines. Mortal Instruments.
Okay.
Vampire. Yeah. What was it? Wait, is it? What was it called? They did the first film, which is Jamie Campbell Bower and Lily Collins. And then they did the TV. Then they did a TV series called The Mortal Instruments. But there was this one set in during the Victorian period, which is about, like, angels. It was actually quite interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe. I would like them to have another crack at the Mortal Engines, because that's a fantastic book series.
Peter Jackson, wasn't it?
It was Peter Jackson. And I would like to tell him, have another go. Because I think he could make a good Mortal Engines. I just don't know what happened there. So I'd say...
No shade to Peter Jackson, but, like, we gave you The Hobbit and you did that.
But also...
You know what the only thing I would have?
The Hobbit should have existed.
The Hobbit? No, The Hobbit film should have existed, not in three parts.
Exactly.
That is the only one I'd be curious about watching, because The Hobbit is such a fucking good book.
It's
so good. And I'd actually like to see it not. I'd love to see Guillermo del Toro's version of The Hobbit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
But, you know, he doesn't... That's a part of the del Toro legacy, is him getting projects cancelled.
I know.
But it's okay, because we're getting Frankenstein. It's already started shooting. It's too late. You can't stop it now.
But they can choose not to release it, as we learned. But
no.
It's not with Warner Bros, is it?
If they do that, I will literally...
Is it Warner Bros? Is it Frankenstein? No, it's Universal. Must be Universal. No, it's Frankenstein. It's anyone's.
Yeah, it might be Netflix.
Is it Netflix? Oh, probably, because he's got those deals, hasn't he?
If Netflix don't, if they, I will break in and I will steal the canisters and I will run and I will put it free on the internet for everyone to watch, because
I want to watch that movie. I think that's a good film. We should do a comedy heist film where it's like stealing films just to put them out put them out.
Oh my God. A24, hit us up.
Hit us up. Let's write it.
Thanks for tuning in, and happy viewing via whatever medium is safest for you. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. It makes a difference. And tweet us any questions or hot takes at Fade to Black Pod on Twitter. I'm at Clarice Liu on Twitter and at Clarice Lockery on Instagram.
I'm at Hannah Ines Flint on Instagram and Letterboxd.
Farewell, film friends. It's time to fade to black.